Hello, I'm Stephen Hill, and I'm editor of the British Journal of Sociology and a professor at the school. And this is the third of the British Journal of Sociology Millennium Lectures. This is where I give you the commercial plug. The British Journal of Sociology's millennial issue is on sale immediately outside this hall if you wish to buy a copy on your way out. We had a galaxy of rather impressive contributors. Bruno Latour wrote one of the key papers in the special issue. And Bruno will be giving the talk today. Now, the talk is, how should the social sciences imitate the natural one? And most of you will know that Professor Latour has a long and enviable record in the sociology of science, also a somewhat controversial one. Recently, we had a debate here, I think, last year, where Professor Sokal, Professor Latour were engaged in a rather lively dialogue. I hope today will be equally stimulating and equally as lively. Professor Latour is a visiting professor at the LSE. He's also a professor at the École des Mines in Paris and in the Sociological Centre for the Study of Innovation. I think many people here will not need any introduction to him. He's been working in the Department of Information Systems for the last 2 years and making a valuable contribution to the intellectual life, both of that department and of the school as a whole. I asked him if he could give me the names and titles of some books. He said, well, he's written many books, or rather several. I think he's rather modest and wasn't sure how many of them were in English and how many of them were in French. So at that point, I thought I wouldn't bother with our normal recitation of publications and great honours. And simply, I think I will introduce Professor Latour and hope that he gives stimulating a lecture, as I'm sure he will do, as indeed he did in the special issue of the British Journal of Sociology. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the introduction. I would actually give a pretty boring talk, and not lively, because it's on the philosophy of social sciences, which is not the sexiest of subject, I must say. Last time I was in this theater, it was, as it was reminded, with Alain Sokal in the dispute on the science war. And it was, as you remember, a dispute between science and anti-science. That is, social sciences were, I mean, the sort of brand of social sciences I'm doing was associated with a decrease in the constraints of scientificity, which was threatening the quality and the authenticity and autonomy of real hard science. So the debate was framed and dramatized in this very room as the one who wanted to loosen the constraints of science and those who wanted, on the contrary, to make them more stringent. Well, time has passed, fortunately, and the entirely different agenda is now for discussion tonight. And I want to use this time, I won't say of peace, but at least truce, to get a bit further and trying to show you that the argument which engaged the sort of social sciences I do with the natural sciences is not trying to loosen the scientific constraint, but on the contrary, to increase them by pushing them in a different direction. So it's not, I hope you will accept that as a frame for the discussion now. It's not the question of decreasing the quality of science, but of modifying slightly the shibboleth, the way we test good and bad science. I'm in a field called science studies, or sociology, anthropology of science, or philosophy, or sociology of science, doesn't matter too much, which has used method from the social sciences in order to probe the way the natural sciences are produced. So my talk tonight is in something which I've called political epistemology. That is, it's not about epistemology proper, because I don't believe that there is something like epistemology proper, except if we mean by that science studies, that is, the study of the way science is produced. So I would distinguish epistemology, as the name indicates, the science of science, or the study of the practice of science, and something entirely different, which I will try to show should not be confused with, which I call political epistemology, which is a distribution of role and speech act among and inside a polity. So political epistemology is concerned by saying who is allowed to speak, who is allowed to have a last word, are non-humans allowed to speak, and who will speak for them, through whom they will be allowed to speak, and who will have the last word. So if you don't mind, for the reminder of this talk, make a distinction, which I know is not canonical, between epistemology, study of science, and political epistemology, distribution of speech terms, so to speak, which is a very important part of the polity. Nothing that you have to be surprised here, because as you know, one of the founders of the philosophy of science in this school, Karl Popper, wrote as many books about the way to organize the polity as about the way science is made. And it has always been the case since Plato's Republic. Every time people speak about what science is and how it should be organized, they also immediately are in the next chapter or in the next book or in another way talk about the way the science, the politics should be organized and who should be allowed to speak and not to speak. So the debate which I just want to show you where I am going so that you see the end of this paper and you can anticipate it, is that the social sciences have a very different type of tonality or of type of interest. If they imitate the epistemology, that is the way the natural sciences are being produced, or if they imitate the political epistemology of the sciences, the natural sciences. So my talk is very simple, and as you can imagine, it's a plea to say, let's try to imitate the epistemology, that is what is interesting in the practice of science and the production of the natural sciences objectivity, and let's be extraordinarily diffident of political epistemology as a model for the social sciences. So you see my argument is extremely simple, and I'll make it as boring as possible. Sorry, not as boring as possible. I will use a work which is not well known in English, unfortunately, which is Isabel Stengers, who is a Belgian philosopher who worked for many years with Ilya Prigogine, and who has written a number of books, very influential in France, about a new falsification principle, which is basically an argument she has developed in a seven-volume book, small volume, called Cosmopolitics, not in the Kantian sense, but in the sense, more Jamesian sense, of the politic of cosmos. And she has a student who is now a colleague, Vinciane Desprez, who is working also in philosophy of science. And I'm going to use the work of these two very bright, non-well-known, in English at least, French-speaking philosophers to make my point. And if you disagree with my argument, I will say it's theirs, which is a great advantage, and not mine. So let's start now with what I could call the traditional pecking order of the disciplines, which I'm sure you are very familiar with, the sort of gradient that organized the discussion of these matters in political epistemology around an order that goes basically from physics to French deconstruction, the one being the highest and the other one being the lowest, of course, where the divide is organized around this notion that when you study natural objects, you can produce a very rigorous type of science. And now when you are dealing with intentional human, you have a choice, and very well known in this school, the choice is either to treat the human as much as possible like pieces of nature, either because they are gene, or because they are rational choice, or because they are many, using the statistical debate, or in another line, you say, well, I don't want to treat them at all as natural objects, and I will develop some sort of, let's call, to make it fast, hermeneutic definition of the social sciences. I'm sure you're all familiar with this long debate. Should the social sciences imitate as much as possible the natural one by treating in many ways as much as possible the human like the natural scientists treat the object, or should we, on the contrary, retreat as much as possible from the natural sciences by inventing some sort of hermeneutic sciences where we abandon the dream of rigor, but at least we capture the intentionality and endless reinterpretation of humans. Now, this gradient, this very traditional pecking order, and it's literally a pecking order, a picking order of money and budget, of course, it's not simply philosophy, has nothing to do with epistemology per se, but it has nothing to do, and that's what I want to show tonight, with the way the sciences are produced. But it has a lot to do with political epistemology, again. That is the distribution of turn-taking and who is allowed to speak and who is allowed to have the last word. So what I'm going to do now in the main part of this lecture is to complicate it a bit, as you can imagine, the pecking order, by using very simply some of the very simple argument that you get when social sciences start to inquire with very traditional method from ethnography, psychology, history of philosophy or anthropology inside the locus and the site of the natural sciences. And some of you, I'm sure, who know the literature in science today will be very familiar with the sort of situation we find when we walk into a laboratory or get to a big science-making production site. You get things like the first visible, easily visible, is instruments. I mean, masses of instruments necessary for the scientist to gain access to reality. You find experimental design. You find things which have been studied very much here by the philosopher of science, paradigms or themata of research program which are necessary for scientists to activate, and as necessary as the instrument, that are necessary in order to activate the access to reality. You find also something which is very rarely described in philosophy of science, but which has taken a lot of importance now, colleagues, dear colleagues, that is the masses of other scientists necessary for the production of science. You get a lot of publication, a whole range of information, technology. You get public relations and public reaction to the sciences. All of that is necessary for the practice of science and is easily uncovered by the smallest and shortest analysis of the way in which the natural sciences are produced. So when you get the social sciences to have a look at the natural one, the pecking order is already a bit perturbated because you already get a lot of this collective activity necessary for the production of science, and the stages of a pecking order are mixed up. I mean, even some discourse, which would be very low in the pecking order, are actually visible through the study which have been very interesting on the writing of scientific paper by scientists, just to take an example. So what is interesting now is how do you account for this multiplicity of elements necessary for the fabrication of science? The science war was really about this following point, which I hope will make a truce possible, at least as far as I can finish my talk without being interrupted, which is basically a double accounting system. When you are dealing with these masses of elements necessary for the practice of science, which have been revealed or uncovered or developed or deployed by the science students, you then have a double accounting system. One in which you say, the more instruments there are, the more colleagues I have, the more budget I have, the more publication system I have, the better will be the grasp I will get toward reality. That is, the more information I will get, the more mediation I have. And in this accounting system, you have two columns. One of them is saying simultaneously to the credit, artificiality of instruments and quality of the sciences. The more artificial, the more instrumentation, the more experiment, the better the science, and the closer the grasp to reality. In the debit of this accounting system, you say badly articulated, boring, trivial science. The first thing I heard when I entered the laboratory many years ago, where I did my first fieldwork, was by Roger Guillemin, who get after that a Nobel Prize. I mean, not because I was in the laboratory, but unrelated. It's, oh, you are a sociologist. You are going to explain to me why I have so many bad colleagues who do nothing. And I never understood why there were so many colleagues polluting the discipline where I am. And you are going at least to explain to me why there were so many colleagues. So I was introduced the day one to the question of the quality of science, which had nothing to do with the difference between being equipped or not being equipped. But being equipped and producing trivial science and being equipped and producing good science. But then, and if not, there would be no science war, there is a second accounting system. The one in which you have a credit and a debit column, but where in the credit you have access to reality, and in the debit you have all of the mediation necessary to produce the sciences. And that's a great surprise, because that's exactly the situation that explained the science war. When people like us in the science study show that all of the instruments are necessary to produce science, for us, we use the first accounting system, and we will say the more instrument, the better. The more artificial design, the more access to reality you have, which every scientist in his common sense would agree, of course. And yet, the discussion, the public discussion at least, will get with the other accounting system, where you will say, no, we want an unperturbated, untouched by any mediation, access to reality. And if you don't give us that, you are a relativist and a dangerous Frenchman. I would call the first accounting system constructivist, not social constructivist, constructivist. And I will call the second one empiricist, not empirical, empiricist. The history of this empiricist being explained, I hope, later or in the question time. 3 minutes of reflection is enough to show the absurdity of the second accounting system, the empiricist one. It will be like imagining scientists saying, if only I had no instrument, no Cray computer, no assistant in my laboratory, no colleagues, no textbook, no PR, no bureaucrats, no politicians, I would produce a really good science, physics, or biology. If only I had no medium of culture, my microbes will grow marvelously. If only I had no astronomer, if I had no telescope, I would have a fabulous access to astronomy, and so on. No scientist in his good sense would ever say that, at least not when budget time begins, of course. And yet, everyone will, in the discussion of the science war, will have to answer this question. Do you really believe that all of these instruments and materiality and colleagues and numbers of elements necessary for science that you talk about are decreasing or increasing the quality of a science? Of course they are increasing the quality of science. That's why they are devised. That's why scientists produce laboratory in the first place. When they ask for money, when they try to produce the access to reality, they use the first accounting system, obviously. The more artificial or the more constructivist we are, the better scientist we are. The biggest, the accelerator, the most deep particle we can get. The best scientist and artificial maker of experiment I am, the more grasped reality I have. And yet publicly, the discussion is always, you have to choose. I mean, if you start to show the necessity of all these people an instrument necessary for science, it means you are a relativist. How do you explain that in 3 minutes you make the argument, you show that the argument is impossible, and the persistence of an absurd dispute of a science war? Well, there are two reasons for that, I think. Two at least, which I know for tonight. One of them is the weight of what I will call the optical metaphor. That is, this idea that scientists, natural or social, actually, it's a question of gazing at the world. And if you have this gaze metaphor, if you introduce between the gaze and what it is to be seen, filters or telescopes or instruments of some sort, it will, in the gaze metaphor, be inescapable that you are actually hiding the access or complicating it. The more filters there is between me and reality, you would say, the less access I have to reality. The optical metaphor makes obligatory to have this very strange argument about the fact that the more mediation, the worse it is. Now, if you don't use the optical metaphor, but if you use a path metaphor or a trail metaphor, you are not so much forced to discount all of the mediation as unnecessary or as biasing you. Bias is another of this optical metaphor which is constantly used. So if you use a trail metaphor, you can perfectly say the microscope is what allow me access to for instance, the microbe. I mean, it's through that path which I have access to the microbe. So when you want to account for the quality of a grasp, you are not to discount the microscope and say, if only I had no microscope, I would have a better access to it, which you will do with the optical metaphor, with this idea if we were only could get rid of all the mediation, we would have a direct access to what we are seeing, which is very unlikely. But the second reason is the political epistemology of the empiricist tradition. We think, especially, I must say, in this country, believe it's a fact of nature that the organization of the empiricist tradition has given us mute object, speaking scientists. Scientists, when they speak truthfully, are actually spoken through by mute object, which is odd. And the whole result being a form of speech that can shut up the speaking politician. I mean, if you think of it, it's very odd. Mute object, we are nevertheless able to speak facts, speak for themselves. Through scientists who speak, but when they speak, they don't speak, the facts speak. The whole thing being able to shut up the speaking, endlessly speaking sophist and politician. This is not natural. This is a very odd form of political constitution. It's a very odd distribution of role about who is allowed to speak and who has the last word and who is representing whom. It's a political epistemology. It can't be the way the things in the reality are. The empiricist tradition is very little empirical. Actually, it's so not empirical that it's more like a fantasy. The second point I want to make now is then about where do we get this notion of objectivity, which is so strange, which doesn't actually work in the definition of the description of the natural sciences. I want to introduce, I'm sorry for this little bit of jargon, the difference between objectivity, that is lab experiment produce what I will call recalcitrant object. I hope recalcitrant exists in English.
Yep.
Good. Recalcitrant object. Usually it doesn't bother me at all if it exists or not in English. When you give an oral talk, it's always better to speak the language. Recalcitrant object. That is, as Popper would say, what is great in laboratory experiment is that you're actually dealing with object which can disprove you. They can blow you up, basically. They can force you to falsify your hypothesis. This has absolutely nothing to do with objectivity as a state of mind. And I was always wondering why the same word objectivity could qualify the object and their way to be recalcitrant in the laboratory setting, and objectivity as a state of mind. And then I realized I'm doing now field work in a Supreme Court, law, in the law, and in one of the Supreme Court in France. And I realized that most of what we mean by objectivity in epistemology is actually coming from the law, from a completely different process by which you obtain disinterestedness, distance, uninterestedness. And in the law Supreme Court I'm studying in France, called Le Conseil d'État, you have a whole series of procedures so that the people who are actually in charge of judging are not too much interested in the file. And just to show the contrast with science, and I'm contrasting the law Supreme Court with the laboratory to show all the different little difference by which objectivity is obtained in both cases, you have things like the same rapporteur who is in charge of a file is asked to write 6 months after having seen the file two projects for judgment, one for rejection and one for cancellation, which is very odd because it would be like a scientist the day before a big meeting who would say, well, I don't care. I wrote a paper saying that this black hole exists and, well, I'll write it, but it does not exist. I mean, and the guy without absolute no interest in the matter at all will rewrite a project completely different from the other one. Why? Because what has been obtained is precisely the state you never get when you study laboratory practice: indifference, distance, disinterestedness. It's not by surprise that justice is always blind and has always a balance. Yes, it's blind and has a balance, it hesitates because it's deeply uninterested. It doesn't matter, it's not for an interest and passion. Now you walk into a laboratory and the idea of having judgment passed on a file by people who don't know about the matter, and the whole process of a Supreme Court is precisely made to be sure that disinterest is obtained and that judgment is actually given by people who know nothing about the case. I mean, the whole dispositif is made for that. It's completely different if you are in a laboratory situation, where, on the contrary, passionate scientist is what is required. Now, why is it that the passionate scientists produce objective facts has nothing to do with an objectivity as a state of mind, nor as distance, nor as disinterestedness? It has to do with the fact that the objects are recalcitrant. They can blow up. They can just disprove. They can submit to trial and produce answers completely unexpected by the passionate scientist. In other words, the amount of passion for the object doesn't deter the object from showing or eliciting the recalcitrance if the laboratory and the experiment has been well designed. So a large part of what we call scientific, in the way we use the objective, is actually coming from the law, and this very important feature of the law, which is to have the last word. Now, what does it do with, I understand that from the point of view of political epistemology, to have the last word is a very important feature in the constitution of turn-taking and who is allowed to speak and not who is allowed not to speak. What does it do in the description of science? It's not where the science, it should not be there. It's something very different. So I want to propose to distinguish objectivity, that is the property of object to remain recalcitrant in laboratory situation, and objectivity as a state of mind, which is more reminiscent of law, and which include disinterestedness, distance, and so on. Third point, what about now the social sciences? Well, the social sciences have inherited a lot from the natural sciences they want to imitate, and a lot from the law. And that's where my argument becomes complicated, and that's where I'm going to use Isabel Sternberg's very clever, slightly counterintuitive argument. What should be studied then? What should be imitated by the social sciences in the natural one? Should we imitate their political epistemology of the natural sciences, that is their double accounting system? Certainly not. Should we imitate their epistemology, that is their ability to produce in artificial situation, and don't forget, artificial is in the same credit line than quality. Should we use their ability to produce recalcitrant objects? And finally, should we use this mixture of law and science, which we call disinterestedness, distance, and having the last word? These are the three models offered by this mixture of natural sciences and the law to the social scientist. Now, here I think I would need something like a drama to make the argument feasible. The solution of lots of social scientists is to say, okay, we know all this difficulty, but we are going to obtain in our domain, the social sciences, the same type of distance, disinterestedness than is obtained, they believe, in the natural sciences. So here is the difficult part of my argument, but after that it will be simple, and it will be finished. It's a comedy of error, if you want, and here I'm giving a voice to Isabel and making a little part of theater, which is maybe, well, fitting in this place here. The social scientist, in a bit of a despair, turn to the natural scientist and say, well, we imitate you as much as possible, and yet in your eyes we are never scientific enough. To which the natural scientist retort, be more scientific. That is, we don't know what it means, because scientific means this three thing I said, political epistemology, law, objectivity as a state of mind. And the social scientists say, we try, but we get never higher in the pecking order. I mean, there's still a very great barrier between the sort of quantitative social sciences, demography, economics, some part of psychology, and even the lowest of the natural sciences. And here is Isabel Stenger's interjection. Well, maybe there is one thing you have forgotten in your imitation game of the natural sciences, which is the objectivity, the recalcitrance of object, their capacity, whatever you think about them, to blow out your question and force you to revise them. to which the social sciences are very crossed now. And they say, we have, on the contrary, we have produced a lot of setup inventing very complicated things like blind tests, like statistics, like imitating the natural sciences as much as possible to obtain uninterested object studied by disinterested scientists. And we do everything in a psychology laboratory, in an economic department, in a sociology statistical department, and so on, precisely to obtain disinterested scientists studying uninfluenced social or psychological actors who do not have any say on the setup. We make sure that they are not influencing the result by their biases. So we did exactly what is supposed to be a produced, a good science. Aha, answers Isabel. But that's not enough. Because you are studying human who share your libido sciendi, who share your scientific ethos. And I'll give an example in a moment. And the social scientists now get very cross. And they say, well, we have disinterested scientists studying uninterested human. What is the flaw in that? And Isabel, in a quite fierce and impolite way, says, yes, yes, you are producing, you disinterested scientists studying uninterested people, uninteresting sciences. Greatly uninteresting sciences. But that has nothing to do with the natural sciences. The natural sciences are not producing uninteresting sciences. They have, no matter what they believe their political epistemology is, and they're mostly wrong on that, the way to produce objects which are recalcitrant to their making. Now, what's the equivalent of objectivity in the social sciences that you forgot to include into your design of your experiment? It's the ability to produce objectors. Objectors is what is the equivalent in the social sciences of the objectivity, the inner recalcitrance of entities to rephrase the question you ask about them. Now, the natural object, of course, have a peculiarity. They are completely uninterested in the question you raise about them. I mean, this is disputed, because if you start already with living organisms, as you know, there are lots of disputes about that. Rats will not work, but let's say electrons, probably cells, monocellular, I mean, unicellular. I mean, you can put the barrier wherever. Yet they are uninterested in your research design. They don't care. Is this the same for human, tricked to be uninterested by a scientist who believes he or she is imitating the natural sciences by imagining a design where he or she masters the design? No, says Stenger, for a very simple reason, is that natural scientists don't master their object. Precisely, they don't. Laboratory can explode. When is the last time that a social science laboratory has exploded? When is the last time that the Department of Economics has blown up? When is the last time that a psychological laboratory has been destroyed by mistake in the design? Where is it? And that's exactly the argument that Isabel gives, two examples, which is, compare what you know about housewives studied by a statistician in, let's say, the 60s, and the same type of data you obtain when the statistician has the door shut when he or she tries to interview a feminist housewife. Where is the most data being produced? Well, in the second case, according to Isabel, because the statistician now encounters an objector, someone who shut the door to the interviewer with the questionnaire. This is the one that resembles the natural object. The feminist housewife resembles more the objectivity of the natural sciences than the passive cultural dope studied by the social scientist in the vain illusion of tricking her into answering question so that it's sure that she can't influence the result by the classical way you treat statistics. She gives another example which is even more disputable, which is the drug case. What's the difference between studying drug without drug addict in it? I mean, where is the difference? It makes a big difference to have drug addict in the definition of addiction. So the dramatization now is finished, and I can now you see the argument is what we should imitate, what we should be able to produce in the social sciences is as many objectors as possible. So now the question is your design being able to maximize objectors? Not does it look scientific according to an ethos of science which has never occurred in the natural sciences, because the natural sciences don't master the object are recalcitrant by nature, because they are disinterested in the question, which is not the case of a human. And she gives the example of Milgram's experiment, which I'm sure you're familiar with. This very famous experiment, which is obedience to authority, in which in the 50s, Milgram trying to show that when you make students, very even American students, in the situation where they have to inflict a punishment, what they believe a punishment, on people, they actually go to extreme length. I mean, you have guys as to, which is of course not a real guy, really getting the electric current, but you can go to extreme length. The people go on and go on and go on and put the electricity to the students, believing they have to learn through electric current, no matter what the suffering is. Now, Isabel in Cosmopolitics 6 has revisited this experiment at length. I've shown that the book should have really been titled Obedience to Scientific Authority. Because what is at stake there is a perfectly scientific design with lots of blind control, double blind. Everything is perfectly scientific according to the tradition of what is scientific. And yet, what is missing according to her in the experiment is precisely that in the name of science, people forget their recalcitrance. And what is funny, if you read the book of Milgram, is that it's full of exactly what people say in the interviews. They say, well, this guy had a white coat, I believe that it was what he was asking me to do was very important, and I didn't dispute the protocol. So what it proves is that human can share the libido sciendi of a scientist. It proves that Milgram is a torturer. It doesn't prove anything about the students, because the students were not put in a position of being able to show their recalcitrance. Everything was made to trick them. And the tricking doesn't improve the scientificity, according to Isabel Schibolet, a bit. On the contrary, it means you put your student in the situation which no natural scientist would have ever dreamed of putting an object. And the extraordinary, slightly counterintuitive argument of Stengers is to say social sciences treat your human as well as the objects of the natural sciences. That is exactly fine. The same artificial, rare, and scarce setting, because it's difficult to produce, exactly like in the natural sciences, in which objection is maximized. It's not, and that's the great advantage of the argument, scientificity is not something all-terrain. Tout-terrain, you say what? All-terrain for? Yeah. So something, I mean, you will don the white coat, you say, I'm a scientifically minded social scientist, and you become social scientist. It's very rare to be scientific. And because why is it very rare? Well, it's very rare because it's very difficult to find recalcitrance, especially in humans. And you see, the argument has nothing to do with hermeneutics. Because in the hermeneutics argument, it could be confused at first sight, but it's completely different. Because in the hermeneutic argument, it's because humans are strongly resisting to become object that you have to be engaging with their intentionality. Stengers' argument is exactly the opposite. It's because humans are so fragile to the libido sciendi that it's very easy to trick them in behaving like object. And on the contrary, what you have to try to do is to obtain a setup which is absolutely not hermeneutic. Treat them like natural objects. Yes, that's exactly what you should do. It's not, of course, empathy. And Vincent Desprez has written two marvelous books on ethology, which is a very interesting comparative study, sort of science studies type, of ethologists studying birds, which is quite an interesting field. That's nothing to do with empathy. Because on the contrary, in order to produce good social sciences, you have to produce exactly as much artificial situation as the natural sciences do. Artificial, again, being positive, constructivist. And when you do in the empathy argument, you can just absorb yourself in your feeling and completely forget exactly as much as when you are not empathic. Of course, it's not an argument about the natural sciences either. Because the natural scientists are protected from the danger of their political epistemology because of the uninterested characters of their object into their study themselves. They are naturally protected by the fact that the object don't compete. And it's slightly different from common sense, because what we mean often in the social sciences by the adjective scientific is disinterested, distance, and last word, which actually has nothing to do with science, but a lot to do with law and the distribution of role. So now I can finish my argument in the 7 minutes left to me. Is this right?
Yes, it's fine.
We now have three words. I'm sorry for one of them, which is a bit jargon. Objectivity, which is the capacity of recalcitrance, which is sort of ingrained into the natural object by the distance they have with us. We have objectivity as a state of mind, that is the sort of thing you obtain in law by distance, disinterested, detachment, and so on. And we have objectors. Objectors are this very specific type of humans who are engaged through a protocol, which itself is scarce and rare, in being able to falsify the social scientist hypothesis. Now, the strange thing, and I want to finish on that, is that it's much more easy to produce natural sciences than social sciences, according to this argument. Let me take an example which will introduce this thing and allow me to close. 2 years ago, the Swiss had a referendum about the use of GMO, genetically modified organism, as you might remember. You might have one in Britain, actually, because your prime minister changed his mind yesterday about it as well. Which is very interesting, because the referendum didn't show up at the beginning. I mean, it was sort of late in the process. If you deal with these people who are doing agronomy, botany, economics of agriculture and so on, it was absolutely obvious, genetics, molecular biology, that the maize, the corn, the soybeans had to be interrogated for protocols maximize their recalcitrance. So lots of protocols in order to make sure that the genes and the plants expressed themselves. I actually, the word expressing a gene is a local term. Everyone agreed that the genes, the soybean, had to be made to speak in some sort of sense through the medium of all these many sciences. And it took about a year and a half before realizing that the same should be done of the Swiss. Strangely enough, the fact that the gene spoke was obvious and the protocol had to be devised. The idea that, after all, the Swiss were to be interrogated was long in coming. Why? But they had representative, elected representative, journalists, and masses, of course, of sociologists, psychologists, anthropologists. So who need to consult the Swiss?
To consult
the Swiss. Now, this is very odd, because now we have come to a point where the natural sciences' respect for the recalcitrance of the object, in spite of all the thousands of talk about hermeneutic, intentional object, and so on, is such that it's absolutely obvious that in a debate like that, which is a world debate, a Swiss debate, you have to take into account the non-humans. But the notion that humans are made to speak easily is common. And it's exactly the opposite. It's very difficult to find the right protocol to make the human speak. And I don't think the referendum, by the way, is a very clever way of making the human speak. But you see that when we deal with the empiricist accounting system I started with, the question is not even raised. Who are representing the non-human? Well, it's the scientist, the natural scientist. Who is representing the humans? The sociologist and the elected representative. But this is not probably a very good polity It's not a very good political epistemology, and I want to conclude with this argument of political epistemology. Remember, political epistemology is not about the way science is produced. Political epistemology is about the distribution of speech power, so to speak. Power to speak, power to stop discussion, power to close, power to be interrupted. Now, if you take the GMO food debate, to which your prime minister now is one of the spokespersons, together with lots of lobbies, ecologists, Scottish disputed scientists, other disputed scientists, and so on. How are we now to account for this distribution of speech? If we use the old pecking order, that we distribute the speech according to the first solution, and ranking the spokesperson of all these entities according to, do you pertain to the natural sciences, to the hardcore social sciences, to the soft Mickey Mouse social sciences, and so on, you will not be able to get at all this debate. Or you would get a nightmare. That is, a debate in which closure is obtained prematurely by some of the representative, and don't believe it will be the representative of science, it will be the representative of industry, or the representative of lobbies, or the representative of members of parliament, and so on. We don't know who would close. But we know that we would have premature closure. Or the other thing, which is not a nightmare, I mean, I don't say it's a dream, but it's somewhat different, where what is in question is the maximization of objectors. That is not the association of the natural, of the social scientists imitating what they believe is the natural one. Let's shut down the voices of all these objectors by knowing in spite of themselves what they are doing, but where the question would be maximize objectors. And it's a very practical question for scientists now. I was reading in the paper this morning that a lot of the discussion, American expertise about GMO had actually been censored, and that there were lots of dissenting scientists. In this, I should not speak about that, but in this very famous dispute between the French and the British about beef, the French was condemned, but the French very cleverly reacted back by attacking the European Commission for having obtained a false consensus on dissenting scientists, because there was a dissenting view inside the scientific community in Brussels. And the French attacked legally the European Commission by saying, you obtain a consensus, but the dissenting voice were not obtained. What is a polity where the sciences are not engaged as what as the last word and consensus building, but as controversy, as dissent? It's a very different type of polity we have been entering. It's a polity in which the distinction is not according to the pecking order between those who have the last words, basically in the old time, the hard sciences, and the one who dispute endlessly about values and so on. It's a very different situation. And I think the best philosopher who has articulated this question is John Dewey, who is an American pragmatist philosopher, who wrote a fabulous book, who has a book which has not, how to say that in English, not taken a wrinkle in all these years. It was written in the 30s, The Public and Its Problem, where he offers to the social sciences, I think, quite a good agenda by saying, he doesn't use the word objectors, but it's basically this argument. The social sciences are engaged in something much more interesting, he says, than imitating the natural sciences. They are engaged in representing the public. And what he calls the public is the unintended consequence of action. It's basically what Ulrich Beck would now call risk. It's exactly the same sort of argument. All of the consequences of our action are by definition unknown. It doesn't mean that the social scientists know them in spite of the actors, according to the old model. It means that they have to be represented for the public to exist as such. So the Dewey's argument is extremely interesting for our time, I think, although it's in a very different type of mood, because the idea is that the social sciences have a task of representing the public to itself, and that the quality of the social sciences is what, for Dewey? It's the speed at which they refresh their view on the public. It's the speed at which we change our social sciences, which is, for him, the quality of the social sciences. Very different from imitating the natural sciences by having the last word. in the science social sphere. It's to try to refresh, as we would say now with computers, refresh the social sciences representation of the public faster. And I think it's a very interesting calling for the social sciences now that they are freed from the imitation of a political epistemology of the natural sciences, and that they are on the contrary engaged into the imitation of the objectivity of the natural sciences. It has been said that the 21st century, I forgot who said it, would be the science, the century of the social sciences. Well, that might be a nightmare if you think of it. If by that we mean the extension of the political epistemology of the natural sciences to the social one. But if we follow a more Dewey type of line, it might be a good omen. At least this is the thing I believe was a good omen for a lecture called the Millennium Lecture. Thank you very much.
We have a few minutes for questions if people would like to come in at this point. See any hands up? Well, I shall have to ask a question in that case. Where in the pecking order now would sociologists stand at the beginning of the new millennium?
Well, I have to be polite here, I guess. the sociologist, Dewey and sociology, if you want, I think in a very interesting position, because it's no longer trying to emulate the natural sciences, nor is it taken in by this other solution, which is the hermeneutic line. So, if I take science studies is pretty good. Sociology of science has produced lots of objectors. So the science war, in that sense, is interesting. I mean, so now the qualification is not are you high or up in the pecking order, which I don't think is very important. But where do you leave a trail of objectors behind your discipline? And then that's for every one of us here to do the examen de conscience. How many objectors have you left in your wake, so to speak? How many design have you made where you trick the people you talk as if they were manipulated by forces unbeknownst to them? So I'd say my colleague in France, to use a French example, which is less, Pierre Bourdieu has very few objectors in his wake, and I have a lot. Just to dramatize a bit. Yeah.
May I ask you to comment on a different kind of debate between the sciences and the social sciences, where, for example, a metaphor or analogy is used, borrowed from the natural sciences and applied to social systems, when in fact very often it brings a difficult application, because the metaphors and the analogies are very limited and limiting, and in fact are very often inappropriate when we forget that they are metaphors or analogies. My question make sense?
Yes, a lot. I mean, a lot of the science war was about actually this misuse of scientific metaphors by the social sciences, and rightly so, because of course the transport, I mean, it goes all ways, in all sorts of directions, of course, because the natural sciences are also full of metaphors as well. But the test, again, for I try to get out of this discussion by saying, well, the test is not how many metaphors you use in your setup, trying, for instance, to clean it from every metaphor, which is, I'm familiar with the work in primatology, which is a very interesting field for your question. And can we address the study of the animal, for instance, the primate, without using metaphors like kidnapping, like violence, like domination, and so on? And of course, one strategy is to say, well, we want to use as neutral as possible terms so that we have no metaphor. But it's like in Macbeth. I mean, you can't wash metaphors out of the sciences at all, no matter how much cleansing you do. The other solution is to say it's not the amount of metaphor that makes the difference. The metaphor is, do you produce good recalcitrant object using these metaphors? And that's a very interesting question. For example, if you, to take just a simple example, the people who first identified monkeys by their individuals instead of having class age, like males or females or youngsters and so on, but which started to have individual monkeys, started to produce very interesting results about them. And it was not because they didn't use metaphor. They talk constantly using metaphors about kinship and so on. So it's not the abstinence of metaphor or the use of metaphor, to answer your question, which makes the difference for me in this little, if we use Stenger's shibboleth, it's, does it produce recalcitrant object in the end? That is, do you allow the monkeys to falsify the account you give of them? And it's obvious for non-speaking monkeys that it's much harder for speaking humans. That's why that it's so counterintuitive and so interesting in Stenger's argument. We are actually better at studying non-human than we are at studying humans. Not because we don't produce the science of human, but because human talk back and they mimic objectivity very easily.
Thank you.
Question over there. Trevor, we've got the microphone over to you, I guess you should think people at the back culture.
So,
it's working, just speak into it.
So the equation, I'm very interested because I'm an architect and we've
because
always,
what?
I'm an architect and we've always been considered to be somewhere in between the sciences and the humanities as a discipline. So I've been working on these problems myself for quite some time, but I'm very interested in your argument, the apparent equation between interest and response. Particularly interested in the disappearance of the natural as a result of that kind of equation. And I wonder if you could answer the reverse question rather than the social sciences imitating the natural sciences, should the natural sciences imitate the social sciences, or is there a reversal position which is being offered, or is there something like the Derridean kind of just we're interested in the balancing of this argument rather than a reversal?
The first question is about the relation between interest and grasp of reality.
The relation between interest as a word,
yeah,
and response.
Yes.
In other words, something human was thought to be interested, but something natural was formerly thought to be only responsive and not a matter of...
I will finish with that one. I'll take in reverse order because in fact the first one is not really the topic of my talk, but it's a thing which interests me. I just finished a book in French, which shouldn't be in English, on the politics of nature, which is around this question of what do we do with the relation between the social and the natural sciences once we consider them as spokesperson for entities which actually do already collaborate in reality. So when we have already GMO plus molecular biology plus lawyers plus big companies, plus what is the sort of space in which they collaborate, which is not a collaboration, an interdisciplinary collaboration. It has much more to do with a parliament. And that's why it's basically an elaboration of this argument I made earlier of parliaments of things. I mean, we are entering a situation where prime minister talk about GMO in a relation which is not just an application of a consensus building made by the scientists somewhere else. And that, I think, is a new polity. Now the argument of natural is not saying anything about the natural not being there. I'm just taking apart two elements of the natural sciences, access to reality and having the last word, the unity of nature, and the access to reality is entirely different. I mean, James is very interesting in that with this notion of pluriverse, not universe, but pluriverse. Sciences has access to the pluriverse. Now, having the unification of nature, the one nature, is a political process. And that's where the tension is, of course, with the science war. That's the interesting part of the science war. Can we have a reality of the sciences in the plural detached from the problem of unification of what I call the common world? This was the topic of this the classes I had the pleasure of doing here at VLC. Now, the first point is very interesting because it's very difficult to make, it's simultaneously common sense, and yet all the fight we had with our colleagues in the sciences come from that. The more interested you are in sciences, the better are the results you produce. I mean, it's so completely obvious. The more passionate days and nights you're trying to trick in an experiment a microbes to survive in the right medium of culture, the more the medium of culture microbes will appear. So a practicing scientist will constantly associate the amount of passion, interest, dedication, artificiality, and grasp of reality, first accounting. Now, discussing here at the LSE Theatre, we would say, well, you have to choose either the reality or the interest. And only disinterested scientists will pass the test. It's a non sequitur. It's completely different than that. And what I want is precisely to try to be able to recapture for the social sciences this extraordinary ability of the natural sciences to be passionately interested, artificially constructing setup, where the recalcitrance of the object is made visible. But it's very difficult for the humans, because humans are not recalcitrants. You say, I'm going to study torture, we'll behave perfectly well. In the name of science, we'll do everything, Mr. Milgram. And they say that in the thing. If I 1 minute, Vincent Desprez, whom I mentioned, and Isabelle Stengers did actually an experiment. Reusing Valin experiment, I don't know if you are a psychologist here, but Valin experiment is an interesting one where you ask students to see at the time pornographic images, and then they have a heartbeat connected to the heartbeat of someone else, unconnected. And then after a while you ask them, which is the image that has aroused you most? Right? Horrifying experiment, of course, but scientific in the spirit of the time, that is, the students are tricked, they don't know what is studied, and so on. And it happens, of course, that the most you are influenced by the heart of someone else. Fine. But we did the experiment last year for an exhibit I did in Antwerp. And of course, they couldn't show pornographic, it would have been disgusting. So they took images of photo, reportage, striking images, and in the news. They confirmed the statistics, by the way. Yes, when the heartbeat accelerates, these are the images which are most remembered. But then they produced a setup with objectors. That is, they made the people speak about the reason why they thought they were influenced by a heartbeat no one of them believed was theirs. So what was interesting is that first every student say, oh, it's a psychology experiment, so we are going to be tricked. It was absolutely impossible to find a naive student believing in what they think. Second, they all say, well, we knew it was not a heartbeat. You knew that it's not your heartbeat, and nonetheless, the statistics are the same. Yes, and then they entered in all sorts of interesting things, like, we have been made, yes, I knew it was not my heartbeat, but I was made aware to features of this image I would not have never been without the heartbeat, and so on and so forth. So here's it's a large domain of collaboration in the social sciences where if we could recapture this quality of the natural sciences, interest and grasp of reality go together. I mean, it's so obvious. I don't know, we have to make the argument, and yet we have to make it.
We have two more questions that I've already indicated. The gentleman there and somebody back there. Thank you.
If I understand the argument, you're aiming towards multiplying the number of objectors, and then having got that in a sense is a test of what you're putting forward. Could I go on and say, when you multiply the objectors in order to get all these tests and all these voices, how do you then deal with the results? You have to make some evaluation of the results. You have to make some analysis of the results in order to reach what in the social sciences is important, some kind of decision recommendation. But how do you go on? I mean, where in the science war can you find, is it the natural sciences you look to, or is it the social sciences you look to deal with the results of the objections in order at the end to come to some conclusion? Then, of course, since the conclusion will not be agreed by everybody, how to put into effect, if we're dealing with people in a democratic situation, the fact that you're going to get dissent among the objectors, they're not all going to agree. How does the science war help us on that?
How does the science war help?
How do you help us on
that? Oh, yeah, but the science war don't help at all in this, because the science war refers to a debate precisely, one out of which, yeah. Well, that's the question of what I call the politics of nature, where you can't... See, the question implies precisely that it was a great advantage to shortcut dissent, to have the possibility of not making the objectors proliferate. So I'm not saying my argument is correct. I'm saying we have simplified the question of democracy quite a lot by having this enormous resource of shortcutting this question, the very question you raise, when we could say, well, in spite of what people say and believe, they nevertheless, we as a social scientist, economic sociologist, psychologist, psychoanalyst, etc., know what they are and what they want. Of course, my position and Isabel's consequence of a position on drug addiction and many of the issues in which she has fought are very controversial. But what is interesting in Isabel's argument is that she has been controversial with Prigogine physics and with drug addiction. So that's what she's, and feminist theory. She's interested precisely in that connections. And I think I have no answer to your question, except that's the question we have now, we can now raise without believing we can shortcut it by saying, well, since we have the natural sciences plus the social sciences, we don't need to do politics anymore, basically. That's simple enough. If only the natural sciences could be, if only the social sciences could be as scientific as the natural one, England would be populated with Socrates and Einstein. Nothing will be resolved. Politics will start again, exactly in the same way. Even if all the Englishmen were and women were Einstein and Socrates, which is far from the case, of course.
Right, we have one last question, then we have to wrap up.
In the theory that you've expounded, where they were advocating maximizing recalcitrance and talking of the Milgram experiment, as you did, and saying that the human subjects being studied were tricked, did the people writing the papers or the books that you referred to discuss the other different feature compared with the natural sciences in which the humans being studied can and do trick the social scientists? I mean, in other words, the trickery can go both ways, and they can and do deliberately lie and deceive, whereas the natural scientist studying the gene and what it does and doesn't do, okay, it can be recalcitrant, but it's not going to deliberately lie.
That's very interesting, because Isabel has been studying a lot precisely this situation in the case of her critique of psychoanalysis, which in French, of course, was a bit of a riot, because we believe a lot in psychoanalysis, and we believe it as a science, mind you. In France, the socialists in France were mostly psychoanalysts, which is strange enough. So she precisely, this is a sort of recalcitrance to which, for instance, in the famous debate about influence and hypnosis versus psychoanalysis, Freud was, of course, very well engaged. The idea of the contrary, we are going to stop all these methods of influence because we are constantly being manipulated by the subject. That's why the notion of interest is getting in his argument. We have to share interest with the objectors. We can't do that with electrons, of course. That would be a waste of time. They have much better way of objecting, which is to not obeying to us. The equivalent of that in the social sciences, according to the argument I made here, would be precisely to interest. So the deceiving, in other words, is part of the setup. And that's why she's working now with a man, a very controversial man in France called Toby Nathan, against psychoanalysis with the notion of influence. I mean, influence is what psychology is about. And instead of saying, you are deceiving us or we are manipulating you and we are trying to distance one another completely, let's include the diffidence. Let's interest you to the manipulation. And I think that's a very interesting line in Vincent Desprez's book on emotion. I hope it will be translated in English. It's a quite remarkable philosophy of the laboratory setting studying emotion, which could answer this question.
Well, thank you very much. You've, in fact, taken the last turn, which I guess is your right. Let me just say, you introduced yourself as a dangerous Frenchman. I think I'd rather say a subversive Frenchman who, in a speech of great eloquence and wit, has managed to turn upside down a fair number of previously understood conventions. When I next get the door slammed in my face as I go on with my ESRC-sponsored grant interviewing 2,500 people around Britain, I shall be very pleased. You know, the subject has spoken back and the recalcitrance of the objects are firmly displayed. Thank you very much, Bruno. It's an excellent talk.